91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. Today it's an hour of cattiness. No, not trivial gossip, but discussion of feline friends and why they mystify and delight us, usually. Good afternoon, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. We'll visit with writer Thomas McNamee about his book, The Inner Lives of Cats, The Science and Secrets of Our Mysterious Feline Companions. He ponders a few ethical questions concerning cats, like the dilemma of an indoor life versus outdoor patrol. Cats love the outdoors, but are at great risk. Only the uninitiated think cat vocalizations are but meows and howls. They're capable of much more and speak volumes in facial expression and tail attitudes. That's next. First, the news. Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman with today's Topical Currents. We're all about cats this hour with a blend of history, folklore, physiology, psychology, ethics, and even grief.
Many people are passionate about their cats. Some folks are indifferent. Some shouldn't have them at all. Never give a kitten as a gift, and don't subscribe to the theory that cats can just survive on their own.
And they don't have nine lives. With us now is natural history and conservation writer, novelist, and biographer Thomas McNamee. His latest book is The Inner Life of Cats, The Science and Secrets of Our Mysterious Feline Companions.
And Thomas McNamee joins us from KQED in San Francisco. Welcome to you, Thomas.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
Well, it's our pleasure, I can assure you. So today's program, I want to say, is for cat lovers as well as cat loathers. And you, the latter, may find yourself converted to the former after today's program. Thomas, you mentioned many times that it's mostly men who, shall we say, dislike cats. Did you discover the reason for that, or why others have this strong antipathy?
I did not discover the reason for this, as a matter of fact.
All right.
I wish I had some idea. I don't. There's just something apparently feline about women that men seem to lack.
Well, although lots of men love them. You say you wrote this book out of a sense of guilt. Explain that for us.
Yeah. Our cat, Augusta, who is the hero of the book in a sense, it's her life story forms the backbone of the book, was dumped in the snow at our ranch in Montana in a blizzard in December. And somebody just, like, it's unimaginable, but somebody just dumped this little kitten in the snow at the head of our driveway, which is a quarter of a mile long. And she wandered down. Luckily, there was a truck track in the snow that made it possible for this kitten to walk on the packed snow of it. And she apparently had wandered down through that, crossed the bridge over the river, found a warm spot in the barn, and I found her the next morning. And my wife and I raised her with very little knowledge about how to do so. And as she grew up, and we eventually moved to San Francisco from Montana, we just made a lot of mistakes along the way. And Augusta taught us about her. We didn't learn about cats from books, which we should have. Although I must say the books available at the time were not as good as mine.
Right.
But and so looking back about all the mistakes we'd made with Augusta, I thought it might be a good idea to write a book about mistakes and how easily they're made and how easily they're corrected, how easily they're avoided. The farther I got into it, I realized there was an awful lot of scientific information about cats that really hasn't made it to the public. And I thought, well, that's a book.
As Augusta, it seems that serendipity can really play a large role in many cats' fortunes.
It's true.
We know that.
Some cats wander. Some cats are, far too many cats are just dumped and lost. Kittens are abandoned all over the place, and they have to find their way somewhere. Many of them die, unfortunately, but cats, as you say, have a lot of serendipity in their lives.
I must admit, Thomas, I was really surprised that you already had what you called the barn cats before Augusta. So that was, I guess, when you didn't know much. And why, how did you view them that you didn't think they needed much human contact? You said there was a barn hand or whatever that kept a feeder filled with food for them, but otherwise they were just on their own.
They were. I didn't pay much attention to the barn cats. We had a ranch manager who fed those cats, and they seemed completely self-sufficient. They were a brother and sister who didn't really pay much attention to the people either. I mean, they looked at us and watched over us, it seemed, but they were more interested in the horses. And they were just a sort of benign presence on the ranch, just like the horses and the cows.
Well, yeah, and they didn't have interaction with humans. Unlike dogs, you found that, you know, that are naturally demonstrative, cats need a little love and encouragement to demonstrate theirs, and they show it differently, correct?
That's right. Cats have a deep and complex capacity for love, but it has to be cultivated.
Well, let's look at some of the most common, we're going to get to a lot of the science. I'd like to look at some of the most common misconceptions that we have about our feline friends in order of the most egregious misconceptions. What would you, you know, I guess it's that we think they don't need love and they don't give love. Would you say that's the biggest one?
Yeah, you know, people refer to cats as aloof, independent, that they don't care about humans at all. That's ridiculous. They're not aloof at all. I mean, you can create an aloof cat in the same way you can create an aloof person by just giving them no emotional sustenance. And all too many cats actually end up that way because they're simply starved of care and attention. People think that cats can just make it on their own. You know, you get tired of a cat, you just take it out and dump it in the woods. In fact, some cats, can survive that way, but they're not happy about it. They have a remarkable ability to adapt to a wide variety of environments. Cats can live in the desert. Cats can live in the forest. Cats can live in cold climates. Cats can live in deserts. They're descended, in fact, from the North African wildcat of the Middle East and North Africa. People often think that cats can be happily left alone for long periods of time, even when the cat very clearly loves you. This is a terrible thing we did with Augusta. I mean, we got married when Augusta was hardly a year old and took off for Europe. We were gone for a month, and we left her in the care of this kid who we thought was, you know, he promised he was going to play with her and take care of her and so forth, and it later turned out all he did was show up at our house twice a day and feed her and then leave. So, you know, when we came back, she was a mess. So talk about guilty, you know.
Oh, right.
And I know a woman in San Francisco who used to live in a little studio apartment with a view of a brick wall, and it was not exactly a stimulating environment for her cat, and she'd go away and, you know, with a boyfriend for the weekend, and she'd come back and the cat would leap into her arms and purr and be so happy to see her. And she thought, well, of course my cat was perfectly happy all weekend because look how happy she is to see me. She must have been happy all weekend. Mm. Well, of course the cat was miserable all weekend, and the reason she was jumping into this woman's arms and purring and being so happy was because, well, she'd been miserable all weekend and she was so happy to see her owner.
You know, I find I do this, and I think many of us come up against the dilemma of anthropomorphizing our cats, our animals in general. So what are some guidelines? How do we determine when we are doing that and when it's real? Like just now when you're talking about the woman that used to, you know, leave the cat looking, staring at a brick wall for 3 days and then jumps in its arms and it's because it wasn't happy. I mean, how do we know when we're anthropomorphizing?
That's a tough question, really, because anthropomorphizing, which is attributing human characteristics to an animal, can be a window into empathy. It can also mean that you're, you know, giving your cat the idea of complexities, intellectual complexities that the cat is incapable of. The best way to avoid it is simply to observe with really scrupulous attention and see what the results of a gesture by the cat or a vocalization by the cat result in. So that behavior is clear. And eventually, as you really watch your cat and listen to your cat, you figure out what the cat is actually doing and meaning. And, you know, the cat is probably not going to suffer from, for example, guilt. You can handle all the guilt you like, and they'll certainly provide you with some if you like. But the cat will never feel guilty or ashamed or even embarrassed. If you look at all these cats on the internet, these comical cats supposedly demonstrating their supposed senses of humor, well, cats may have a little bit of sense of humor, frankly, but the people who turn cats into actors of sorts or comedians on the net are kidding themselves if they think that's what the cat is meaning to do.
You touch on that, Tom. You kind of frown on it. Of course, you don't want to see any cats online, you know, being toyed with. But just the notion of using them as that sort of entertainment kind of grates on you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does, because in many cases, it's to get the cat to do something that's supposedly funny. The way you do it is to scare the cat. A friend of mine sent me a link to a YouTube video. It showed cat after cat after cat eating food out of a bowl, and then somebody off camera puts a cucumber behind the cat's thigh. And so the cat doesn't know the cucumber's there, and then suddenly notices the cucumber and jumps up in the air and runs off. Mm. And if you see 10 of these in a row, and each cat reacts exactly the same way to the cucumber, jumps up straight in the air and runs away. And if you see 10 of these in a row, it's funny. It is funny. But, of course, what you're seeing is 10 cats having been scared half to death. Now, why they're scared by a cucumber, who knows. But it's funny, but it's cruel.
They might think it's a snake.
Yeah, well, animals for any form of entertainment, I mean.
There's a website called Cats That Look Like Hitler.
Oh, my God.
Somebody said to me.
Some of the most popular cats on the web, and I'm not going to name them because otherwise people probably try to burn my house down, are physically deformed. You know, they've got a funny face because they were born deformed. And people are now, in the most grotesque way, actually breeding cats with physical deformities. For example, extremely short legs so they can barely waddle along, or even to have, for example, extremely short front legs so they have to hop like a kangaroo. I mean, this is obscene.
Well, on that note, and we'll change the subject when we get back.
We're speaking thank you.
Thomas McNamee. He's an award-winning writer, author, and Guggenheim Fellow. He's written The Inner Life of Cats, The Science and Secrets of Our Mysterious Feline Companions, which was awarded a Guggenheim Fellowship. We're going to be right back after this short break.
And we're back. It's today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and Thomas McNamee. We're talking about his book, The Inner Life of Cats. Thomas, could you touch on Rome and its population of feral cats is something like 300,000 around the historic sites of that city?
Yes, and they've been there for centuries. The one that I particularly focused on and loved is a place called, it's a ruin that's been excavated and explored right in the middle of the city called the Largo del Torre Argentina. And there's a biologist there named Eugenia Natoli who's been studying those cats for decades now. And there, it's a temple complex. There are three temples and the old theater of Pompeii where Caesar was stabbed in the year, whatever it was, 22. And the place is absolutely crawling with cats. And it's beautiful. And there are other, virtually every old monument in Rome is also crawling with cats, the Colosseum and the whole, all of Imperial Rome and the other ruins that are in less central places are all actually cat refuges, and they are taken care of beautifully by volunteers, mostly women, who feed them, and they have veterinary care. And
they spay and neuter them.
I beg your pardon?
They spay and neuter them?
Yeah, they do spay and neuter them, absolutely. And it's an interesting situation, actually, because the idea is that those populations will be controlled. But in fact, as is the case in so many other places where these supposedly feral or semi-feral cats live, people come at night and they dump kittens in there. And so the populations inevitably grow and they... So these refuges also function as adoption centers. And they're very popular to places to go to just look at cats climbing up on the columns and running around. They live very peacefully in very high densities, which is an interesting thing because so many people think that cats are asocial because they do. Their wild ancestors are. And... most people think that cats basically can't get along in close proximity to one another, and Rome certainly proves that that's not the case.
Well, we're going to get to the feral cat population issue. It's a very controversial issue, of course, but we want to touch on it, you know, before the end of the program. But I wanted to bring up just that genetic component that you said that was discovered in cats that took exposure. This is so interesting. It took exposure to humans to be expressed. And it belies the idea that cats are aloof and don't thrive on human contact and have this huge capacity, or it doesn't belie that, but they do have a huge capacity for love. Would you talk about that?
Sure. I'm not perfectly confident that it was a latent genetic quality. I think it is. But our cat is a direct descendant of the, as I mentioned, the North African wild cat. These are all, and there are a number of subspecies of this species called Felis sylvestris all around the world. There's a there's a European wildcat, there's a South African wildcat, there's a Chinese wildcat, there's one in South Asia. And the kittens, if you raise a kitten from any of those other subspecies, it will be completely wild. It'll tear up your house, it'll pee all over everything, and it'll bite you, and you just can't tame them. But to this day, if you steal kittens from a mother of the North African wildcat, you can raise it in your house and it'll grow up to be a perfectly nice little kitten. But it won't become a loving and a companion and sit in your lap and purr like one of our house cats. So clearly something happened along the way as the kittens of that subspecies came to be associated with humans, probably just guarding granaries or something like that, because we know that that subspecies developed over the course of somewhere between 10,000 and 5,000 years ago, along with the development of agriculture. So they certainly hung around humans in the first place, killing rats and mice and stuff like that, because humans began to store grain. And presumably the kittens were nice and played with children, stuff like that. And somewhere along the line, they did develop this capacity to be really loving and tractable and funny and great to have around. I really don't know. We don't know when they became true house cats. It may be as recently as the last few hundred years. And that role as a house cat and with children and really learning to be gentle has developed this amazingly complex system of behavior and attitudes that we can legitimately call love. I mean, there are scientists who say, oh, well, it's not love. It's just sort of a transaction, you know. You feed me and I'll pretend to be affectionate. Mm-hmm. Well, of course, human love can be broken down in more or less the same way. You make that transactional, too, if you want to be cynical about it.
Right. Talk about that study by Eileen Karsh, because, you know, often you go to, let's say you get your cat from the Humane Society or whatever, and it's not really afraid, but it has a couple of feral tendencies, or you find it in the street or whatever, but it never really gets to be as loving as other cats do. But talk about that study, because it really all depends on how early they interact with humans.
Bonnie, this is the most important thing in my book, and I was just lucky to have stumbled on this one study by a scientist named Eileen Karsh that was published as part of the publication of a conference in Switzerland in the middle 1980s. And it was published right before the Internet became our principal source of scientific information. Eileen stopped work at about that time. She retired early. And what she had discovered, I think, is something that's just not known, even to veterinarians and other so-called experts on cats, is that kittens' brains develop in a certain way if they're handled by humans. And by handling, I mean being cuddled and held up close to the face and put in your lap and so forth and talked to at a very, very early age, as early as 2 weeks, when they're just opening their eyes and their ears are starting to stand up. And then over the course of the next, say, till they're, say, 7, 8 weeks old, gradually being exposed to disturbing noises like a car horn or a vacuum cleaner and being approached by children and dogs and that kind of thing. When a kitten is raised that way, you're almost guaranteed to have a tractable, brave, even-tempered, loving adult cat. And the general gospel today, of course, is that, you know, you let them stay with their mothers and let them have a nice, peaceful upbringing by their mothers, and then they'll be ready to adopt somewhere between 7 and 12 weeks.
Right.
And that's the way it's done today. And basically, except in a few places, nobody touches the kittens at those early ages. And Eileen's study is the one that shows that that's really the way it needs to be done.
I mean, I have seen, in fact, I had, you know, full disclosure, I used to take care of colonies of feral cats and feed them, spay and neuter them, trap, neuter, return. And several of them I ended up taking. But one of them who was not touched, and again, it was at least 3 months before I could catch him. He became the most loving cat ever with me, but he didn't trust anybody else. He was afraid of everything, everybody. People used to say, do you really have that cat? Because no one ever saw him. And that's what happened. I mean, he came from a feral mother, but he wasn't touched early enough. He became very loving, but not to other people. Just as you say, you know, not brave. Quite the contrary.
I mean, certain cats. I mean, I know a guy who adopted a 7-year-old feral male cat who eventually became a complete teddy bear. You know, it's obviously there's a lot of individual variation in cats, and it's not to say that a cat that's raised in a different way isn't going to become a great cat. They often do. I mean, Augusta eventually became a great cat, but she was if a guy came in the house wearing big heavy boots, clomp clomp clomp, Augusta was shot under the bed. She never changed in that way, and she never sat on our laps. I don't know why. She'd lie right next to you, but she wouldn't sit on your lap. And these presumably had to do with God only knows what her kittenhood had been. I mean, you know, the kind of person who dumps a kitten in the snow probably wasn't a really great mom to the little baby kittens.
May have been a big man with big boots.
I've read that often.
I'll bet the man in that house was. Actually, we think that she, I speculate that she came from this trailer park in Big Timber, Montana, where there, you know, there was, you know, meth on the premises and that kind of thing.
I've read that it tends to be that the kittens need to have the mother to teach them how to hunt, but your Augusta really proved the opposite of that. She became quite proficient without any training.
Yeah, I think that's true for cats in general. In fact, years ago, I published a book, my first book. It's called The Grizzly Bear, and it was always gospel that bears needed to be taught to hunt by their mothers. And then years later, I found this place in Boise, Idaho, where a woman raised orphan little tiny bear cubs whose mothers had been run over or something like that. And she raised them until they were about 2 years old and turned them loose in the wild. And those bears did great. The whole premise of bear biology was that mother bears taught their babies everything, how to understand the habitat, how to find their way around, which plants were good to eat, how to kill a squirrel. And these bears turn them loose, bang, they just could do everything. And so certainly kittens have a lot of instinct as well.
Well, they have so much of their wild ancestors in them. I think I have read that they have more than any other animal, that they have more of their ancestral characteristics than any other animal. The wild.
Well, yes. If you compare our domestic cats, at least particularly the hybrid ones, not a Persian or a Siamese, something like that, but if you compare just a regular old tabby cat with the North African wildcat, they're very similar. And a lot of their habits are the same. The wild cats have a midden, which is the center of their universe, where they eliminate, defecate, and pee. And, of course, our cats have their litter box, which is in many ways psychologically the center of their universe, a very important thing in their lives. And they have all these marking, the way your cat rubs her chin on the furniture or on you. That's a deposition of pheromones to mark territory. Wild cats do the same thing. And they really haven't been domesticated for very long. And some people say they're only semi-domesticated,
right,
even now.
Right. We're speaking with Thomas McNamee. He's an award-winning writer, author, Guggenheim Fellow. The Inner Life of Cats is his latest book. That's what we're discussing. And a short break. We'll be right back.
And we're back with today's Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and writer Thomas McNamee. We're talking about his book, Cats, the Science and Secrets of Our Mysterious Feline Companions. Thomas, let's talk about kittens and cats and playing with them. You say that a mock kill reward should be used if possible, such as if you like to use one of the laser pointers that cats go crazy over, at least at the end, somewhere you have to simulate some sort of a kill or else they get bored.
Yeah, I'm kind of an opponent of laser pointers because it's so hard. First of all, it stimulates them amazingly because I guess it's like they look like a bug flying around. But it's very hard to get that sequence going and then provide the kill at the end. It's better for me, I think, to have like one of those bird toys where you can actually, have the bird flies around, the cat jumps up, grabs the thing, and then is allowed to grab it and bite it and kill it and, do that thing with their back feet where they're seeming to disembowel it. Or, for that matter, our favorite toy with our current cat, Isabel, is a big, long red ribbon with a knot in the end of it. And she chases that. She can chase that all over the house, and then you slow it down, and she jumps on it and kills it. And, of course, your cat will teach you how to play with it. And if you, as everybody knows who owns a cat and has tried to play with it, there are a lot of different ways you can fail at playing with a cat because, everybody's had the experience of you've tried to do something with a new toy or try to get the cat to get into the game. The cat sits and stares at you,
right,
clearly saying, "You idiot, don't you realize this is not the game?
This is not working."
Yeah, this is not working for me.
You bring up another point that I think is interesting. Let me see if I can find it. It had to do with, usually we think of this in terms of dogs, but you talk about, and you mentioned about the different natures of cats, that you need to get the right cat for you. I mean, they are different by nature. Some are more active. Some are more high-strung, you know, just like dogs. But people don't usually think of that. They think they're just going to get this cute little kitten, and then it doesn't work out, and they end up back in the pound.
Yeah, and it's hard to know because all kittens are adorable.
Right.
And it's hard to figure out which one is going to be a nervous, very active one, and which one is going to be just a napper. But it is very important. That was another thing that Eileen Karsh worked on, was trying to match
adopted
kittens with the right kind of person. You know, if you're high-strung yourself, and then maybe you want to have a calming cat. And maybe the best way is to adopt a somewhat older cat when it's begun to develop its individuality. But it is something of a gamble.
And she had, and I, as I recall, she had great success. I think 11 of them she was successful. Was that it? With the ones that she placed with people?
Yeah.
Out of 25 or something, I don't remember. And then some gave it back,
myself.
And then she found different homes for them that worked out very well. It had a nice story. It was a nice, had a nice ending.
Yeah. I mean, depending where you adopt a cat, sometimes you do end up having to take it back, and they'll find another home.
You also talk about another thing that's very important, which is punishing cats, that it doesn't work. I mean, certainly—
Never. Never punish a cat. Just all it does is make the cat afraid of you. And you can train a cat to do almost anything with rewards, simply with rewards. There's this great thing called the clicker, a little metal clicker that you can buy in a store anywhere. And the deal is when the cat begins to do something that only slightly resembles what you want him to do, then you click the thing immediately upon the behavior, and then you give them a little treat, like the stuff that comes in a bag from the grocery store. And eventually they learn to associate the click with the reward. Eventually, if you really get good at it, then you can just do the click and they don't have to give them the treat. But you can teach cats to roll over, jump up on a table, keep them from jumping on a table. You can teach them to retrieve a ball. You can teach them to jump through hoops. There are actually these associations of people who have cats run around these tracks with all these obstacles that they have to negotiate, and they time them. And so my cat races against your cat through the obstacle course. And the way they've trained those cats is with the clicker.
And we can get that probably at any pet store.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I think you can get them in a drugstore or something. Just any sort of, I don't know, sundries store, I guess is the old-fashioned term.
Right. You talk a lot about the vocal sounds made by cats, and this was something that I never thought of before reading your book. They only make them with humans, not with other cats, except the initial contact with their mother. So talk about that and the science and that study by Mildred Molk, I think was her name.
Yes, that's another one that I've unearthed that I think is generally not known. It was done in 1944, and Molk studied her own three cats for years, listening and listening and just paying attention and watching what behaviors were associated with which types of vocalizations. And there, of course, cats can't make a lot of different kinds of sounds, but they can put emphasis. One would be a rising one, with one a slightly louder one. And so she was able to identify such things as acknowledgement, confirmation, demand, but not just those kinds of, those were just the most general categories. She also found the whispered demand, the silent demand, the begging demand, or bewilderment, but bewildered failure of understanding, or bewildered worry. Worrying bewilderment, and then, of course, complaints, demands, and then various forms of anger or fear, a growl, a snarl. And, of course, as you say, mother cats have a few things they say to their kittens, like, come over here, or don't worry. very basic things. And then cats, unneutered cats, when they're in their mating ritual, have all sorts of yowling and stuff. So they do talk to one another.
We've all heard that.
But but you've, a language can develop between you and your cat with a lot of subtlety and a lot of variety. And the interesting thing is that the language that develops between you and your cat might be different from the language that develops between your neighbor and her cat. But there will be a general sameness to it. So, I mean, you know, the sort of feed me or let me out sounds, you'll get those pretty well universally. But the subtle stuff, of like the bewildered failure of understanding that Mildred Moke identified, you have to work on that one, but it will come if you listen carefully. And when you talk back, of course, it's usually helpful to try to say the same thing back.
So, like, we should be mimicking them?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Hmm. Let's take our last break. We're going to come back and take some calls. We're speaking with Thomas McNamee. His latest book is The Inner Life of Cats, The Science and Secrets of Our Mysterious Feline Companions.
I'm a barn cat, not an alley cat, or a house cat. I don't sit in laps. I got a real job. I catch mice. It's a tough life.
That's Barn Cat by Mary Ann Kennedy.
Nice harmony.
Yes, thank you to Michael Stock for that. It's today's Topical Currents. We're speaking with Thomas McNamee. He's an award-winning writer, author, and he's a Guggenheim Fellow. His latest book is The Inner Life of Cats, The Science and Secrets of Our Mysterious Feline Companions.
Tom, oddly enough, before we booked you on this program, I happened to read your biography of Craig Claiborne. My compliments to you on that.
Oh, great. Thank you.
Yeah, your things run the gamut from fields of natural history and conservation to biographies and novels. You even wrote, I guess, that documentary, Alexander Calder.
Yeah, that's right. My father always used to say I was a mile wide and an inch deep.
Yeah, but that won a Peabody Award and an Emmy, so I don't know about the inch deep. So let's get to the subject of the feral cats. And the colonies and their burgeoning populations and outdoor versus indoor. I mean, it's a rough life to be an outdoor cat. The cats suffer, but you dispel one of the myths about the bird populations in North America suffering. And talk about, you know, I mean, the human's role in all this. So
this is a very complicated subject, and it's hard to treat in any simple way. I'm glad you brought up the question of the suffering that feral cats themselves undergo. All too often, people talk about feral cats, they talk about the harm that they do, and not the harm that is done to them. And I often feel that in many cases, the trap, neuter, and release method, while it does reduce populations, it also returns cats to places where they're not going to lead very comfortable lives. Right. They're still in places where there's a lot of traffic, they get run over, they get killed by dogs, they get killed by people, and so forth. But yes, they do kill birds. They kill a lot of birds. The question, however, is not as simple as just that they kill birds. They kill in some places, particularly on islands and in island-like habitats, they've driven species to extinction, and they are driving species even now toward extinction. And in those places, those cats need to be gotten rid of, all of them. In some cases, that means that people have decided they have to be killed. Of course, they can also be trapped and moved. in other places, even though they might be killing a lot of birds, they might just be backyard birds like house sparrows and robins. Those birds can absorb a lot of predation. If cats don't kill them, something else is going to kill them, or the weather's going to kill them, and they just lay. That's why they lay a lot of eggs in the first place, or in many cases, if they're all their young are killed, they'll lay a second clutch of eggs. And so you read these very, very large numbers of birds being killed by feral cats, and in many cases, it's an impressive number, but it's not necessarily those numbers don't necessarily represent the reduction of populations.
Which loss of habitat may.
That's right. Loss of habitat is the key thing in the reduction of many, where we have, if you take it species by species and you take one that is, say some songbird, like a warbler, let's say, whose population is declining, well, it's very likely not due to cat predation. It's much more likely to be its winter habitat in Mexico or something like that that's been destroyed by logging or whatever. Habitat loss is almost always the key thing in the decline of any species on Earth.
So TNR is not necessarily the answer, but there really, until something better is come up with or is found, at least it tries to. I mean, if humans weren't irresponsible and, if they spayed and neutered their cats or didn't dump them places, a lot of these feral colonies would dwindle. But that's not the
Absolutely.
Case.
I mean, this business of people just dumping kittens in parks and things, it's an outrage. And I hope that sometime we'll have more effective education campaigns to bring that under control. I believe cats should be licensed and that then people at least could be sometimes caught, licensed, that is, in having a microchip implanted under their skin and their necks, the back of their necks, and then you could trace the owner of the adult cat, anyway. And I also would hope that one of these days we'll have refuges, like in Rome.
Right.
There are quite a number of these colonies that are bounded, and sometimes, they're in an excavated temple complex, like the Largo Argentina, or they're places that are fenced and with wonderful places to play, trees to climb, little pools for the cats to drink from, and little houses they can get in and out of the weather, and they have a wonderful time. And they are feral cats. In many cases, they've been injured. There's one with a fabulous blind cat who can find his way all around the place. And there they're protected from being run over, being killed by dogs and so forth. And, if we had a system of refuges like that, rather than just turning feral cats loose back in the alley where they came from, it would be a lot better.
Tom, touch on you and your wife's torment, so to speak, with your kitty Augusta, whether to be an outdoor or indoor right. cats and the travails she encountered.
Yeah. Well, in Montana, it just seemed, first of all, she just had to be an outdoor cat. And so she grew up on a ranch, and we were in quite a remote place. We were just a few miles from the northern boundary of the Absaroka Beartooth Wilderness, which in turn is contiguous to Yellowstone National Park. And so we had bears and eagles and coyotes and every kind of predator you could think of in the northern Rockies. And Augusta just braved the whole thing. We were very careful. We tried to be very careful, anyway, about not letting her out at dawn or dusk when most of the predators are most active, and never letting her out at night. But we once saw her, actually, when she wouldn't come in late in the day, and I was out looking for her through this brush, and there are these huge boulders, and I was shining a flashlight, and I saw, oh, my God, there are the eyes of a bear glittering back at me, and behind her, oh, Lord, two little cubs following behind her, and then two little eyes. It was Augusta following the mother bear and two cubs, just trotting along through the brush. It was unbelievable. And so when we moved to San Francisco, well, she was already accustomed to the outdoors, so we just let her out, and she climbed around through the backyards of the little block we lived on. Luckily, it was an enclosed block. It was all townhouses that were contiguous, and so she couldn't get into the street. And she did okay until, and then she got hip dysplasia and she couldn't climb the fence anymore. So we just took our chances in both places. There were raccoons and other cats. There were feral cats in San Francisco. There was a risk there. But we just felt that her love of freedom was something we were willing to grant her, balanced against risk. Now, of course, if we lived, for example, in Montana, if we lived near a busy road, you just wouldn't let her out, because there are a lot of places where you just can't let your cat out because it's too dangerous. Or, for example, if you live on the 48th story on West 57th Street in New York, you can't do it there either. And there's always the calculation you have to make. Is it, do you want to have your cat have that wonderful freedom of roaming? Or if you live next door to, say, a habitat with an endangered bird species in it, you certainly shouldn't let your cat out.
Right. What are your hopes for the book? Who do you want to reach?
Well, I guess the people I'm most concerned to reach are the ones who sort of don't get their cats, the ones who really would profit from the understanding that could be gained from the book. And it doesn't necessarily mean they're raising a kitten. Those who are raising a kitten are the ones who would profit most, I think. But there are an awful lot of people who have cats and don't get them, don't understand them, and neglect them emotionally. And I guess the other people would be the people who are contemplating getting a cat.
Right. Well, we want
And, of course, cat haters. I'd love to get to cat haters, you know, but it seems unlikely. I suppose, I can typically imagine a male-female couple where the woman wants to get a cat and her husband says, in no way, you know.
Right.
We've got this St. Bernard, and that's it. And so she gives him the book for Christmas. I don't know.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Well, we hope it goes far and wide. Thomas McNamee is award-winning writer, author, and Guggenheim Fellow. His writings appeared in The New Yorker, The New York Times, The Washington Post, among many numerous publications. His latest book is The Inner Life of Cats, The Science and Secrets of Our Mysterious Feline Companions. And we wish you well, Thomas, and thank you so much for being with us.
I'm very grateful to you for having me here.
Thank you.
Our pleasure.
And we hope you enjoyed today's edition. Our lead producer is Richard Ives. Technical direction from online feature creator Jason Zabka. Polly Landis is associate producer, and thanks for the assistance of Howard Gelman of KQED Public Radio, San Francisco.
You always have a different title for Jason.
I'm working on it.
What was this last one?
Creator.
Creator of?
Online features.
Uh-huh.
Okay. I'm fine with just creator.
Oh, good.
More information and audio copies of our program available at the website, WLRN.org. We also have the iTunes TC podcast, as well as the Topical Currents Facebook page. Tomorrow's program has twin topics. First, we recognize Saturday's Earth Day celebration with info about how you can help give Biscayne Bay a bit of a spring cleaning. Then Linda Gassenheimer trots out her old cast iron cookware for a re-seasoning. Cast iron is still popular for its non-stick virtues and, of course, its heat retention. And for cornbread, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, thanks for listening. Stay tuned for Here and Now, next from NPR News.